Let me just ask you up front, besides the six-figure appearance fee here for Wake, why come to Wake Forest? What about Cage Fest or Louis's presentation kind of perked your interest to want to come and chat with listeners here in Winston-Salem?
Well, I've been part of the discussion with Louis from, I think, the beginning of the idea of the Cage Fest. I don't know him personally, but I know people who do know him, and then I have developed a kind of a lovely relationship with him just through email. It seems like a very cheerful and very interesting and astute commentator on Cage, and of course a pianist also. And he sent me his own performance of Sonatas and Interludes, Cage's piece from the mid-1940s, and I thought he had exactly the right interpretation.
When you say exactly the right interpretation, for non-Cage fans or non-musicians, mm-hmm. what are you referring to there?
Well, you know, you can, of course, always play a piece of music through the notes. You can play what's written in a certain sense. But beneath the notes, in another sense, there is a kind of awareness that's necessary, an awareness of what the composer was doing, where his own mind was, you know, what Cage's intentions were at that point. And what I found in Louis' playing was that he caught that spiritual restlessness that Cage was experiencing in the mid-40s. Cage had gone through the darkest night of his life, where all kinds of doubts and all kinds of fears were plaguing him. This happened in the early 40s. And Cage looked to Asian religions, in particular to Vedanta, which is a mystical form of Hinduism. He looked to Vedanta during that period as a way out. It was like a larger frame. It was a connection to the cosmos. It was Cage reaching out and saying, you know, who am I in relation to this infinity all around me? And Louis gets that sense of restlessness and intellectual and spiritual restlessness and that trying to reach out that Cage was doing in Sonatas and Interludes. And then the sense that Cage has actually found something. If he's found a place he can rest, you know, if he's found a place that's bigger than he is, where his mind can expand and his heart can expand. So that's what I feel in Louis' playing. I think Louis has perhaps some of those qualities himself.
Thank you for breaking that down for me. I appreciate that. From an interest in Indian practice, a philosophy, religious belief, then Cage moves into the world of Zen Buddhism. Chat just a little bit about what is Zen and what about that practice, Zen Buddhism, attracted you most?
Well, that's a large question. Let me just say at the outset that it's very hard for people who have grown up in the context of Judeo-Christian culture, the thousands of years in our own cultural history that is embedded in these beliefs. It's very hard for people to come to Zen or to other forms of Buddhism as well, because there are almost no points of comparison. So what I'll say to you is that, in part, Zen is mind training. It's a process of watching your mind create phantasms called thoughts and recognizing that you don't have to be dragged down the road by your own thoughts. Or, as I like to say, you know, you don't have to get on that particular train. We talk about a train of thought. Well, there are trains of thought that are really very devastating if you follow them through for yourself and for others. But you don't have to get on those trains. So Zen, in a certain way, is a practice of mind training in which you look at what your mind actually is, what it's actually doing, how it manifests in the world, how thoughts create reality, you know, for you and others. And then the practice is to see the thoughts and to let them go and not grab onto them. Because if you think of how you grab onto something, you grab on with a closed fist. And then that fist becomes a weapon. If you open the fist, if you relax your hand, if you let things pass through you, thoughts and all kinds of things pass through you, then you're a more open vessel for the whole of your own life and everybody else's too. So that's one aspect of Zen. There are other cultural aspects that relate to an embrace of mystery, for instance. To me, Buddhism is the only religion that I personally know about that actually, rather than closing down processes of your own processes of inquiry, it opens them up. So Buddhism doesn't say, here's a set of beliefs and this is what you should believe. Buddhism says, first of all, it says, trust yourself. The Buddha said, be your own guide. and Buddhists take that very seriously. So everything that happens in a Buddhist context is me asking myself, is this true or not? You know, where am I in relation to this? And then you look at your own mind and the way you act, and that's where you find the answers. So that's very different.
I'm struck by early on in this review of your book, the quote of John Cage talking about once one gets one's mind and desires out of its way, it seems like in so many ways I hear that as a goal of every artist in every discipline is to get out of the way of overthinking and over, I don't even know how to describe that. And yet at the same time...
You know, you've really got something there because that Cage quote is a perfect condensed description of both what Buddhism does offer and what Cage got out of it. Because D.T. Suzuki told him, let go of whatever is getting in your way, or what gets in your way. It's your complex of tortured feelings and thoughts that we think we is who we really are. If you let yourself get out of the way, then you're still present. It's just that your obstructions are gone. So, yes, it's a pathway to creativity, because then what arises just arises out of the spontaneous nature of who you are and what the world is. So that's the freedom Cage is talking about, and that's why he used chance operations to create his music. People think that he was, I don't know, turning against the whole history of Western music, which is about self-expression. You think of Beethoven's thunderous conclusions and so on. But actually, what Cage was doing in adopting chance operations was that he wanted to find a method of composing that would short-circuit his own desires and will. That didn't mean that he wasn't involved. He created the circumstances by which he asked the question, you know?
Yes.
And he created the structures, so he was still present. But the answers reflected this cosmic frame that Cage is always trying to pull into his work, you know? The I Ching is a method of divination. It's not just a random number generator, although it can be that, but it also pulls in this cosmic question mark that we all live within.
And that question mark, for one who, for most of my life, as someone who was a classically trained clarinetist, who went to a school to study with a certain clarinetist to have a specific sound, timbral ability to play in an orchestra with carefully written scores, it was difficult for me to embrace the whole chance element in well, not just Cage's work, but those who followed. But you've, I have to say, for the first time, really made me contemplate that in terms of his philosophy, and correct me if I'm wrong, the whole concept of the amount of work it takes within, when John Cage himself was questioned, well, what happens when the I Ching gives you notes or intervals or a set that you don't like? And he talks about the energy it takes to then, rather than just reject that and change it, reflect within and come to a place where you accept and appreciate those notes or whatever you're given and move forward from there.
Isn't that a fabulous idea? When life gives you something that you don't like, you have a choice. You can resist it and say, I don't want anything to do with this, which may not exactly have the outcome that you think it will. Or you can say, okay, I don't like this, but what does that not liking consist of? It consists of my ego sitting there saying to myself, I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to get rid of this. If instead you accept what comes through your own unconscious, through the nature of change and uncertainty in the world, you know, if you accept what comes, then a kind of graciousness enters your life. You can accept what comes in the form of people who maybe aren't exactly like you. It's just a general opening out. So when Cage says that, you know, this life is so excellent once you get your mind and your desires out of the way, the mind and the desires are kind of like a screen, you know, and you take out the screen and then the whole world arises. And what a powerful place that is.
We're headed toward that realm between the conscious and the unconscious mind. And it seemed like that was a very important aspect of Cage's life and creativity, the function of music to help bring those different parts together in a way.
That's exactly right, yes. And we think that because we're verbal creatures and we're talking to ourselves all the time, that's really who we are. No, it's one aspect of who we are, but there are other elements and other parts of us that we can't access that way. I live in the country, and I was just looking at the way that things live here. The trees grow without words. The chipmunks run around the grass without words. They live all their lives without this framework of conceptual structure that we believe in. So what is that about? Where is that in us? And one thing that happens when you stop talking to yourself, or at least when you short-circuit that process, is that you start to feel your own being in relation to all other beings. There's this beautiful image that came out of something that D.T. Suzuki was talking about in his classes at Columbia, and that Cage heard and responded to in a very deep way. The teaching essentially is that each one of us, each being, is the center of the universe, each of us, and that each center of the universe is absolutely connected to all other centers of the universe, so that really what you have is this vast net of interrelationship and interbeing, and what happens to you happens to me also, because I'm part of the net and so are you, you know, and then you tug on one end and the whole world shifts. So The power of that image both suggests why karma is so important, but it also puts the deep elements of me and my own life, my own physical and emotional life, in relation to everything else.
That's
really cool.
It really is. The connectedness of all of us and that center that we all share, it seems to go a long way toward another notion that was so big in Cage's beliefs. The way I'm reading it is that kind of dismissing the ego, we take our emotions and link it to ourselves and the ego and such that it limits us. What does he say? You can feel an emotion, but just don't think that it's so important.
Don't attach to it.
How did that impact his creative work? Maybe not just composition, but leading on to other aspects as well.
Well, from the beginning of his life up until 1950, when he met D.T. Suzuki, Cage was, he wasn't a conventional musician, but he was making music that people in the music community would have regarded as ordinary music. He was making percussion music, he was creating prepared piano, he was creating songs, you know, so sonatas and interludes is a piece for piano, for instance, and although it's got ideas that come from the Indians, it's still basically a piano piece. After 1950, when he met D.T. Suzuki, and Cage got this notion that it's not that, well, the ego obstructs only if you get stuck there. So Cage found numerous ways to get unobstructed, and one of them was chance operations. That was the first thing he created when he met Suzuki. Another one was indeterminacy. So he'd play with radios, with tuning radios to certain channels and then seeing whatever came through. And there are lots of ways that Cage embraced sort of the nothing. Here's Cagean language. Something is all these things that are created and that we think of as who we really are. And then there is the nothing, and the nothing is not negativism or nihilism. It's more a way of saying we don't really know what this life is and what it's really about. And the harder we try to grasp onto a definition, the more we lose it. And really, this life is about living it, about being in the process.
Asking questions.
Cage said, what can be analyzed or criticized about my work are the questions that I ask. So, in a way, you can say that about life, and you can certainly say it about Zen practice also.
Well, both of those things, the concepts that I find so counter to what so many of us grew up to believe, because you alluded to this issue of silence and John Cage's remark that silence is not acoustic, it's a change of mind, it's a turning around. And my whole appreciation of John Cage's music has changed over the course of this festival simply because I'm approaching it from my first college experience hearing 433 and being appalled, and not a lot of fast notes, to really reflecting on the use of silence in music and just in general around us. The change of mind, a turning around.
Isn't that a beautiful phrase? If you see yourself looking out through your own eyes, in a way, through the filters of who you are talking to yourself about being, in other words, you're looking through your own eyes and you're creating yourself by talking to yourself. If you see yourself doing that, then all of a sudden you just turn around, and that construct isn't there anymore. You turn around, and what you see is the whole universe, is this amazing interlocking miracle that we call this life. and you see yourself being a part of it, absolutely indivisible from it. And when Cage first got interested in silence, well, he got first interested in silence in high school, but then the Indians showed him that there was a spiritual component to this silence. It was really about that mystery, about what this universe is when we're not talking to ourselves about it. And then he got to Suzuki's classes, and Cage had this deep realization. He thought that silence was some kind of abstraction, you know. And then he got himself into the anechoic chamber, and he heard his own neurons firing, and he heard his own blood pouring through his veins, and he said, there is no concept of silence. If you turn around and leave the talk behind, what you find is that there's being everywhere. Everything is alive. Every tree, every stone, every cigarette butt, everything is alive. And so when you perform 433, essentially it's a meditative stop. I actually spoke at my Zen alma mater, so to speak, Zen Mountain Monastery in upstate New York near me, and I introduced the talk by performing 433. We all sat quietly for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. These are people that meditate all the time, and they did not find this foreign in any way. It made perfect sense to them. We just all meditated for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and in silence we were part of each other. And then the conversation resumes, and that's okay, too. So the turning around is also a conversion, because if you think of the word conversion, conversion means turning around, literally. And the conversion is, I think, toward recognizing the sacredness of this vast universe and the project of being alive in it. And so 433, it seems like the simplest of things, you know, but it also seems simple to go get a cup of tea and sit by the fire. And yet everything is both totally simple and unbelievably profound. And as a Buddhist, that's what I've found out for my own self in my own life. I have experienced both the complete simplicity and the total profundity of just sitting in the sunshine, reading a book, you know.
For a while, I studied Tai Chi and, in different discipline, a similar effect of reapproaching life through the eyes or mind of a child. You know, after doing the form, you sit and you just let sounds come through you and go without trying to identify them, label them, overthink them. Mm-hmm. And you hear things in a whole new way, for lack of a better way of putting it. I guess, again, coming back to John Cage and specifically his music, it makes more sense to me that rather than labeling mm-hmm. something as being mm-hmm. an ugly sound in this case, or a raucous thing or noise, just accepting them as what they are, suddenly your whole palette of soundscape widens exponentially.
And your whole life widens also, not just the sounds. The sounds are a vehicle for opening your eyes and your mind and your heart to what's already here. And that's what we're always shutting ourselves off from. So when you do Tai Chi and you sit afterwards with the mind of a child, the child is open to everything and grateful most of the time for everything. So how do we get back there? Well, there are all kinds of ways. You know, Zen meditation is one way, Tai Chi is another way, yoga is another way, taking care of your children is another way. There are all kinds of ways, but that's where the opening, that's where the turning around comes from. In writing this book, it was a 15-year process for me because I had to work my way through these questions. So Cage says, get your mind out of the way and your ideas out of the way. And so I had to ask myself, where are they in my way? And what part of me is in my way? So for a long time in my writing career, I've been writing professionally since 1972. For a long time in my writing career, I was always kind of fighting myself in order to write. And in the process of doing this book, I've stopped fighting myself. So now I just sit down and I write. And part of it, I think, comes from that long process of identifying what was getting in my way and letting it go. Identifying it, letting it go. So this book and John Cage have both been deep teachers for me. And I adore him both for being a teacher for me and also for just the beauty of his mind and the openness of his life. And that smile on his face, after he met Suzuki, he started smiling and he never stopped. And that smile on his face, I think, was welcoming to lots of people and is the source of the Cage Fest and other celebrations in this year.
And just as you're speaking, I'm looking at the last photograph in that review, the one that's become so famous, a great, great smile. I guess just missed meeting him in York, just outside of London. The dean of the School of Music there was a friend of my father's, and John Cage had just spent the night there the night before, and he'd signed out their guest book, and I missed him by a matter of like 45 minutes. Regret that.
Wow. But, I met him once, and he seemed to have such presence of mind that he kind of got me, you know, without ever saying a word about it. He just was totally present. And that's another thing that happens when you get yourself out of the way. You're totally present for other people. So I saw him being present for me, and it taught me a lot just in that exchange, even though we said barely, you know, a couple of words to each other.
That's interesting.
So I'm grateful to him, you know.
Yeah. I love the way you put that. That's you talk about emotional intelligence these days. That's not, that's the catchphrase. Everyone's talking about the importance of that and getting a job. But there is that comfortability of just being in the moment enough that you're a great listener and you absorb a lot that way.
You're present for others. Emotional to intelligence, by the way, was created, the phrase was created by a Buddhist, Daniel Goleman.
How about that?
Who studies with the Dalai Lama and has been involved with Tibetan Buddhism for a long time. There are lots of ways that Buddhism is entering American culture without anybody quite noticing.
Very interesting.
And Hindu also, because, of course, yoga is fundamentally a Hindu spiritual discipline, and it's now everywhere in the United States.